Hello and welcome to Roundpeg Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Borhani, geostrategy expert in residence with Business Families Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me today from London is Tom Fletcher, the youngest ambassador in the past 200 years of United Kingdom. And we will be discussing everything and all things politics, diplomacy, because Tom has been the author of the book, The Naked Diplomat. Tom Fletcher, welcome to Roundpeg Podcast.
Thank you very much indeed for having me on.
You've served 4 years as foreign policy advisor to three prime ministers, 4 years representing UK as the youngest ambassador at the age of 36 in the past 200 years, professor at New York University, honorary fellow at Oxford University, and the list of accolades will go on and on and on. But you're best known as the Naked Diplomat and Power and Politics in Digital Age as a writer and as an author. In your book's preface, you start the title with The Diplomat Who Arrived Too Late. That was the first opening. Are you the diplomat who arrived too early? Were you too hot and too fast for Foreign Office, and Foreign Office perhaps a bit too slow and too cold for you? Would that be the right way of looking at it?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think I was particularly unusual. I think there are a lot of very interesting examples out there of people doing all sorts of pioneering, innovative things. I was really lucky that, for me, in those days when we were first tweeting as ambassadors, there were only about probably three or four of us doing it, and it was a novelty. And you know, people were just surprised to see an ambassador on Twitter and surprised when we responded and interacted, engaged with them. And so it was much more fun. It was anarchic at that time, and there were no rules. Now, you know, everyone's on Twitter, so the novelty has gone, I guess. No, I think, look, diplomacy as a whole is not a very risk-taking profession. I mean, culturally, we tend to be fairly cautious and careful. And so if you're willing to take a few risks, then you can have a lot of fun.
Okay, so that very much weaves into what I wanted to just ask you. Is diplomacy, in your opinion, at the moment, and I'm not talking about UK diplomacy, I'm talking global diplomacy, would it be fair to say diplomacy as a vessel is running on an empty tank of vision, on a beaten track of leadership, faulty brake pads to prevent yet another major conflict, and a windshield, in my opinion, that is clogged with past layers of mundane protocols, which many of them you tackle in your book. And it's hard to drive with a car like that and with a vehicle like that in terrains that are interactive, interchanging. Does that make you a fan or a frustrated fan of diplomacy?
I'm still definitely a fan. I mean, I worry a lot about the way that diplomacy is under attack. Many people think they can do diplomacy better than the diplomats, including other bits of government. Many people, you know, I was very struck, this article by Roger Cohen in the New York Times a few years ago, where he said diplomacy is dead. Many people are writing it off as having failed. And actually, you know, Syria is the classic example of how diplomacy has badly failed. But for me, like, when you look around at the new challenges that we're facing now, everything from what do we do about AI to the climate crisis around us, in all those cases, you'll need diplomats to be the kind of lubricant in the system. And so I always say, look, if diplomacy didn't exist, we would have to invent it for these crises. But the reality now is we have to reinvent it. We can't carry on, as you say, using these old, all the old tools that no longer connect with the people that we have to reach.
Now, you are, in more ways than one, a progressive ambassador. You used to be a progressive ambassador, and you remain an ambassador for technology, for digital connectivity, and a digital advocate. I've listened to your talk at Google in 2016. I am a fan of tech, but I'm also very mindful that we're becoming like dories of Finding Nemo, short attention spans, getting carried away under the tsunamis of data, and much of it is in transition. Do you think there is perhaps a symptom of diplomacy from the hip? I mean, tweeting these days is one of the crux of many of the complexities that we're dealing with. You've seen it in United States. And isn't there room for contemplation in diplomacy anymore to be found? Or is that something that keeps you concerned, that, you know, how crises can be as fastly developed as the solutions to catch up with them.
So look, when I wrote the book originally, it was pre-Trump, and I was telling people, you know, we need to get more leaders onto Twitter and engaging people directly and unfiltered and authentic. And you know, maybe I've been slightly surprised by how quickly that all changed. You know, I've always said, and I always push back hard when people think that I'm talking about technology as the solution to all these problems, and that, you know, if only every diplomat had a better smartphone, then it would all be, you know, all the problems of the world would be solvable. It's not just about the tech. The essentials of diplomacy are still that human connection, that, you know, the last 3 feet, one American Secretary of State calls it, between two individuals and bridging that divide, you know, connecting with people. And that was the case, you know, 1,000 years ago, and it will be the case in 1,000 years' time. There has to be space for people who can step back from the day-to-day scrapping and reflect on things more broadly and try and bring together that consensus and compromise that humanity basically needs if it is to cope with this age of new technology. So yeah, I think there's a case for speeding up in some respects and certainly being able to keep up with social media, but also being the people as diplomats who can slow down as well and ground discussions in the way that they need to be grounded.
Let me tell you, I couldn't stop. I was in a coffee shop reading page 171 of your book, in which you were capturing the essence of a meeting between Claire Short, attending to Queen in Privy Council, where her mobile phone went off and she was fumbling for it. And then the Queen reportedly paused for saying, "Is there someone important?" and that was such a, how do you say, brutal moment. And people were looking at me and I was giggling in this coffee shop for like a minute and a half. But when you went to Google, you suggested that companies like Google or Apple, you know, and the big tech companies, obviously you focus on the Western big tech companies, not Alibaba's and Tencent's and all of that, should be invited to UN, should be having even, you know, in a more utopian technology-driven world to be presented at Security Council. And this made me think, it's like saying East India Company to come to be invited to Westphalia Treaty. Is there really a risk of bringing big businesses for their own time and age into shaping the future of the world? Isn't it like bringing the Four Sisters oil companies in the early days into decisions? Or I would like to pick your brains on that.
I think there is certainly a risk. And I reckon that probably since I wrote the book, we collectively have all become a bit more skeptical of the ability of some of these big tech companies to do the right thing. I think there was a phase, you know, back in the mid 2010s when, you know, everyone was desperate to get the Facebooks along to their conferences and desperate to make them part of the solution. And particularly around big data, there is now, you know, a justified level of cynicism about the direction of some of these companies. And you're right, you know, the Congress of Vienna, No one was saying, you know, let's now hear from the civil society rep, or let's now have an ambassador for youth telling us what the young people think, or let alone let's hear from business. But I think the reality now, when you look at these big challenges, is that you have to have these different groups in the room. You know, you can't deal with climate change without businesses and mayors and other organizations being part of it. You certainly can't deal with the challenges of artificial technology without having the tech companies in a room. If you simply have the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in a room talking about AI, the conversation will be irrelevant to the risks and opportunities that are being created at the moment.
No, I hear your point, and I think a lot of people would say, as I said, a diplomat too early and for your own time, but there a lot has changed in between, Tom, as you can say, and a lot of people are concerned about the weight of these companies. And I know that you put the D3 as defense, diplomacy, and development. Or I would call it DD3, digital defense, digital diplomacy, and last but not least, digital development. Is that order right? Is it still a digital defense and digital diplomacy? Or why should defense come first? Why shouldn't development and diplomacy supersede defense in that order?
So I certainly see them as three legs of the stool, and you certainly can't do defense without doing the diplomacy and the development. I think it's when you're approaching it from the perspective of a government, you're always conscious that your first duty, really, to your citizens, to the people who elect you, is to protect them. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's why the defense would come first there. And I think, again, in the last 3-4 years since I wrote the first version of the book, we've all become much more conscious of the threats that are out there from cyber. Mm-hmm. It's very struck, you know, I'm on this the global tech panel, and you know, 79 tech leaders wrote to the UN to say how terrified they are at the threats that are being created from lethal autonomous weapon systems. Mm-hmm. And these threats are being created far faster than we can manage them. And the challenge has been finding even which part of the UN system should even respond mm-hmm. to the left, let alone respond to the challenge.
But I want to move a minute to your vision for the future embassy. I mean, in your book, you talk about a UK embassy in Sweden, which is a thought-provoking image, and I really liked it. I think Greta Thunberg would be very happy with you grounding ambassadors in future and minimizing carbon footprint through flights and, you know, all virtual things as you've tackled in your book. But isn't there as well a gap between having a proper protocol for the rules of engagement in cyberspace today in the world across the board, and, you know, some certain big powers still reserve the right for themselves into hack, intervene, you know, influence other countries' infrastructure. Isn't it a bit like Wild West at the moment, Tom? I mean, doesn't the world at large need a set of conventions and, you know, a digital treaty conventions of how, you know, countries, regardless of their size, you know?
Yeah.
Is that not the first thing to be looked at rather than just saying, how can we hit them first? Because then it turns into another race that is without any, perhaps, structure.
I think we certainly do need to, I would say, upgrade the existing conventions and rules that we have. Actually, you know, if you look at the Geneva Convention, you know, the way that protects our liberties, it can just as easily apply to our liberties online. If you look at the Vienna Convention and the way that codifies diplomacy, again, you're not talking about huge changes in order to make that more relevant to the digital age. So I wouldn't rip apart the existing guidelines that we have. But, you know, again, when you come back to the tech companies, they're saying, look, don't come and find us in 20 years' time and tell us that what we're doing now was wrong or illegal. You know, tell us where the lines are. Tell us where the rules are. Mm-hmm. What ethics of the internet? So there is a huge amount of work to be done there, not just in establishing the rules of the road, but then in actually enforcing them and holding people to account. And there we run up against this real challenge of this lack of trust in authority and institutions, and the fact that, you know, at least three permanent members of the UN Security Council are actively disrupting that international model already. So the challenge is, well, who can stand over these guidelines that we put together as humans, you know, in the second half of the 20th century with such patience and after such huge sacrifice?
Okay, now that's going to take me actually to a country in which you very much shared your political, perhaps beaming identity, which is Lebanon, and to the Middle East at large. Do you miss Beirut?
I miss Beirut every day. I miss it hugely. I miss the people, the energy of the place, I miss the food, I miss the drink. You know, I miss the, you know, the air in the mountains up above Beirut. It is such a magical, vibrant city, and you know, I'm not the first foreigner to fall head over heels in love with that city. I think it's also easier, you know, when as an outsider, it's easier to appreciate all the good things and be less frustrated by the negatives. I mean, I think it's much harder to love Lebanon in that way when you're actually living there the whole time, where you're from, Beirut. But yeah.
So when you wrote that Yalla Bye, which was original in its first as a farewell letter from an ambassador to a country, and perhaps as relevant today about its content, almost 5 or 7 years later. You are an evangelical futurist ambassador of Lebanon, as you mentioned. And you said, I would buy shares in Lebanon 2020. What is the latest update on that share price with everything that is happening? And if there was an annual general meeting today on your share prices, do you think that that share is moving towards the right direction? In some ways, you could say yes, but they are, you know, they're on the street because they said they want to put a tax on WhatsApp, the very tool that you are a fan of, you know, as digital tool. I'm not saying WhatsApp itself. And you said, unlike other politicians and your politicians, I cannot extend my own term. But it seems that they cannot extend their own term as well now. What is your take on Lebanon and your share prices?
That's a tough question. I mean, actually, so that letter, people used to say to me, well, how long did it take me to write that letter? And it actually took me 4 years, really. It was dashed off, you know, on the way to the airport. It was, I thought and agonized over those themes over several years. And it was very much, you know, from the heart. It was really how I felt, very passionately about the problems, but also the opportunities of Lebanon. You know, probably I have underestimated the challenges in the short term. Well, certainly I have. 2020, you know, where are we now? A month or two away from 2020.
Exactly.
And some of the earlier blogs I wrote about Beirutopia and Lebanon 2020, you know, I was trying to just set the vision of what it could be. And I still believe in that vision, but it's clearly going to take longer to get there. But I think a lot of people in Lebanon share that idealism about what the country can be. I think people are realistic too about why it's got stuck in the years since the civil war. And in a way, that's the trade-off. All of us, the Lebanese, but also the internationals, have basically said, look, let's just freeze things as they were, because the war was so horrific and we don't want to go back there. Let's freeze things as they were, because, you know, just across the border, Syria is exploding around us and we can't risk changing things too fast.
Mm-hmm. Now,
At some stage, you have to change.
Listen, I guess nobody can undermine some of the really good works you've done around building dialogue, building, you know, UK-Lebanon tech hub and efforts in and around, you know, contribution of books, etc. But and all of that in more ways than one, as a genuine participant in the society. You also mention in your book on page 198 that UK sells more whiskey, salmon, yachts and luxury cars per capita than anywhere in the world. And my question to you is that for a country that is financially constrained and broke in more ways than one, for an ambassador that really didn't like Ferrero Rocher diplomats and shadowed an Ethiopian housekeeper, Kalkeda Nigwize, which was fascinating what you did, doesn't the country need more than salmon and, you know, whiskey and yachts and luxury cars? Is this a list in terms of inclusiveness of the broader frustrated society in Lebanon today and the youth, or is it the right stack of exports, in your opinion?
You're right. Of course, Lebanon needs much, much more than that. And I hope that, you know, more than anything else, what Lebanon actually needs is a bit of hope. And maybe over those 4 years there, I was trying to export some hope as well. But also, look, I mean, for ambassadors, much of the way that we measure our effectiveness is in the trade relationship. And, you know, all the other aspects of diplomacy, including exporting hope, very, very difficult to actually quantify, to measure, to judge your performance against a set of stats. And so inevitably you do end up chasing after the trade. You know, that's a big part of our job, is to make our own countries more prosperous and more secure. I always thought that the way to do that was not just look at Lebanon as a small market itself, but to look at the potential and the global impact of the Lebanese diaspora. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you can make that emotional, personal connection with the Lebanese community at large, then actually the business follows, because the Lebanese are the, you know, history's greatest business people and history's greatest networkers. So the, you know, that was how we ended up selling so much Panadol and yacht and whiskey and so on. But no, I would never, I'd always be disappointed if my time in Lebanon or, you know, our work of diplomacy ended up being defined purely by trade stats and purely by what we were selling.
No, and I agree with you. And I think that's where I was going with it was not, you know, instead of perhaps, fancy cars or yachts or et cetera, I was thinking about capacity development, vocational training, you know, bringing the infrastructure of electricity back to the grid, which takes me back to another element, and that's the newfound gas in Mediterranean. Do you think it's too complicated to bring somebody like Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund and help them from grassroots of how not to make mistakes? Do you think, I mean, I know that Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund itself is divesting from oil and gas, but this is one of the most important resources for Lebanon at the moment to invest in its infrastructure. Do you have confidence that they would be listening and willing to learn? Or again, it will go into, you know, one concession for this party, one concession for that party. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a really important debate to be had because, as we all know, oil, energy, gas can be a curse as often as a blessing. And it's something we worked incredibly hard behind the scenes, actually, during my time and since, to try to get the right systems in place to really take advantage of this, what could have been this extraordinary opportunity for Lebanon. If I'm honest, I think I have no doubt there is the talent in Lebanon that can work this out. That can learn from the best, but you know, I don't underestimate the talent of the Lebanese people to make the most of an asset like that. But I think that you're right in the line of your question that the politics is probably not quite ready for it yet. And what I could see happening, you know, this real danger that basically we would end up having 9 oil rigs and that there'd be a different warlord sat on the top of each one, extracting as much revenue as they could. And so until the politics are in a slightly better place, I think there's always going to be a big risk with how the resources are used.
Now, Chris Patton is somebody you've talked about frequently in your book and hold in highlight, I assume, as a diplomat. And yes. He wrote a column and an article on ASEAN Post on August 25th, just this year, analyzing, you know, what failed states are. Now, I think it's a bit exaggerated, but he was going into analyzing the failed state, and part of it was dealing with Brexit and government's atrophy in delivering results. Quote, "I would certainly have mentioned systems of government that had ceased to deliver what they were intended to do, and certainly what outside well-wishers hoped and assumed they would do," unquote. But in your book, you mentioned Lebanon is a post-failed state that craves stability. From a time zone and timeline, does that put Lebanon in a more pregnant for serious change than, you know, more ovulating for serious change than UK today in that comparison?
Well, let me see. So, I mean, it's certainly, so what I mean by a post-failed state is that it's in this period where the trauma of what it's been through is still so real. And of course, you know, many of the people who lived through that era and were a big part of that era are still very much a part of political life today. Often and are often stabilizing factors. You know, we always had this great debate about, you know, the extent to which we should be prioritizing keeping the country stable versus the extent to which we should be backing change and, you know, being out in the streets ourselves and calling for things to be better. You know, so I do think there's a generational shift ahead in Lebanon that will come no matter what. So I still, you know, to come back to your earlier point, I'm still buying shares in Lebanon, but maybe I'm, you know, I'm focused on the longer term dividend from those shares rather than the dividend in the next couple of years. For the UK, you know, I'm obviously not completely objective on this. I'm obviously hugely biased towards the UK as I am towards Lebanon. I think we're going to come through this period. I think we'll come out of it, whatever happens on Brexit, with some bounce. You know, we've got many of the things that I think make a successful 21st century economy. Many of those factors are there in the UK, including a very thriving tech industry, a great education system, a great pool of talent, and actually cities like London, which are still as magnetic as ever, whatever happens on Brexit, I'm pleased to say. But what we've got to do is remind the world that we can also do competence. And I think over the last few years, not just Brexit itself, but that the manner in which we've handled Brexit hasn't been our finest hour, let's be mm-hmm. clear. No one can claim that. And so we've got to remind the world that we're actually quite good at stuff. That's certainly where I'd be focusing my energies in the coming years for the UK.
Well, I couldn't agree more that UK has a lot going for it, but itself at the moment, in my opinion. And all those learnings from, all these years and decades and centuries, some of it right learning, some of it in wrong learnings, and we'll come to that. But it has a reservoir of know-how and trade and perhaps connectivity, diplomacy, the rest of it, that could be a major bridge in more ways than one. And that brings me to geostrategic issues in Middle East and Levant, the opportunities, the challenges. Belt Road Initiative is a reality, Tom. It has already started. It's snaking through many of these geographies. I was reading the other day in Financial Times that a Tulip group of hotels with their Chinese holding have bought 4 hotels in Syria. And do you see a great part of the future of perhaps Mediterranean hubs and trades, because of their high risk, because of, the complexities they have, more of a playground for China and Belt Road Initiative? And should UK capitalize on that and be part of it, or just be a bystander and say, we're not going to be contributing to this dialogue because, China and all of things China? What are your thoughts there? And I'm happy to weave into.
So I without doubt, power is shifting east. I feel that very clearly. I live in Abu Dhabi now, and you can sense the way in which people in the Gulf are looking increasingly at the opportunities that lie east as well as west. And that trend is, that's going to be a huge feature of our lifetimes and my kids' lifetimes. It's not going to change. I think the UK can approach these issues, I think, with greater humility mm-hmm. and modesty. And I think one outcome of the last 2 or 3 years will be that we'll be looking at the world through slightly different spectacles. We'll be framing it slightly differently and trying to construct this more modern 21st century identity, rather than falling back on empire and the amount mm-hmm. of the world was colored pink and so on. Now, so without doubt, China's a huge factor in that, and we'll all have to find a way of working with China, working with the grain often of that Chinese expansion. But at the same time, I think we have a huge role in continuing to stand up for many of these values, including the international rules-based system, international cooperation, that China and others are challenging. And we can do a great service to global trade and to the Middle East if we are clear in standing up for those values and rules, because otherwise people will find that fairly quickly what looks like a huge opportunity turns into a huge risk.
Okay, so that couldn't be a better prelude than my next question to you. And I mean, these 283 pages are, in my opinion, a rapid course on crash course on diplomacy and all things thereof, particularly from a British optics and lens. There are themes and threads that, I really enjoyed. I learned a lot, and I didn't find any of it boring, even in one page. But there are pages as well that I want to challenge you on, and some topics. In one of your lines, you say, "One man's propaganda is another man's spin, is another man's public diplomacy strategy." Winston Churchill, the legend of British politics, was a big fan of writing, drawing, cinematography. And there is a beautiful documentary on BBC called Churchill and the Movie Mogul. I don't know if you've watched it or not. It's fascinating. Fascinating. Okay. Yeah. And basically in 1934, he signs up Alexander Korda, who was a gifted screenwriter and producer, signs up Winston Churchill to write screens plays for him, for Alexander Korda. And Winston Churchill then goes back to Alexander Korda, and then he asks him to get on a mission to go to Hollywood to develop movies and to lure America into war. And he did so successfully. Isn't there a bit of a dialogue about the access to some of these tools, the speed to some of these tools? Isn't there a hue and flavor of double standards in global diplomacy that we lurk back, we harp back, and we forget about that, you know, we have been in those places? Why is it that George Bush Sr. is not an ex-CIA, but Vladimir Putin is every conversation in ex-KGB, you know? Why we have to constantly polarize it, you know? And isn't there a new chapter for bringing some dialogue into healing, humor, and moving forward? Otherwise, the tectonic shifts will be there for years to come.
I completely agree. And in a way, that's what I was trying to say, really, with that line about, you know, one person's spin is another person's public diplomacy is another person's propaganda. We're very quick to label anything our opponents say as propaganda while thinking that we are completely innocent and virtuous. I think, to be honest, social media is shifting the ground on this so fast anyway. I think mainly because it gives people more of a sense of their critical faculties, more critical thinking. They're much better able to realize the humbug that might come from their own countries and call it out. They can see the inconsistencies.
I have to interrupt you there. I learned humbug first in your book, then heard it from Boris Johnson. So credit to you. But carry on.
I wouldn't say it's a very commonly used word, actually. You don't hear it a huge amount. But I think in this case, it's the idea that, you know, you can kind of get away with bluffing and so on. And look, there are some leaders in the world today who have got away and are getting away with a certain amount of bluffing. But I think that gradually the public and the international public are getting better and better at seeing that for what it is. And so that's one of the positives of social media. I think, look, you're dead right. We do need to make those connections. We do need to reach out and understand other cultures. One of the things I'm working on now that I love is this system for teaching and assessing global competence, which is the ability to have the cultural understanding, the antennae, really, to understand other cultures and to empathize with them and to find ways to work together beyond differences. And a lot of people call that 21st century skills, but I call that diplomacy.
Well, I couldn't agree more. But listen, today in Australia, all of the newspapers have redacted their covers in response to Australia's censorship laws that are kicking in. You know, many terms as democracy, diplomacy, in my opinion, sometimes rhyme with hypocrisy as well. And the reason for that is when a small country walks away from a global treaty, the next step is sanctions, interventions, occupations. And you know that the United States has walked away from a deal that you were very positive about, JCPOA. And 80 million people are kept as a bargain token in geopolitical rivalries. Don't you think that the U.S. dollar has taken the place of gunboat diplomacy as a tool? Isn't there a threat for the bigger global community in terms of, like, you know, whatever happens, or we cut you off from dollar and you can't talk? Is there a dialogue to be had there in the broader picture of diplomacy?
I think it's a good point. And without doubt, economic sanctions, economic measures, are very much part of the toolkit. The reality is that as power and as great powers rise and fall, of course they'll deploy all the different tools they have, the different instruments they have to impose their will on less powerful countries. Overall, you know, I would take the dollar over gunboats, but let's not pretend that it doesn't have a cost as well. And I think the you know, one of the great dangers here, and the Iran deal that you've mentioned is a great example of that, is that often in the West now you're finding this inconsistency between administrations. Mm-hmm. You know, one of our great strengths is that we refresh our politics, that we replace our leaders. But it can also be a weakness as well. And often we have leaders coming in and reinventing policies and being consistent. And I think, you know, another very contemporary example is what's happening to the Kurds in Syria, where, you know, on the back of two or three tweets, a community is suddenly left, and our allies are suddenly left incredibly vulnerable. So the inconsistency that I would most challenge, rather than the use of the economic tools.
But you and I know both that, you know, sometimes, you know, those economic tools can lead up to 500,000 of children in Iraq, as it was the case for Oil for Food program. So I don't think that, you know, it's far less. But I want to, on the same theme, just take you to a very interesting script of your book, which you say on page 244, so we are 200 times less likely to die in a war than a century ago. The number of wars has increased by 25%, but they have been smaller. Death tolls have fallen from 38,000 per conflict in the 1950s to just over 600 in the 21st century. But whose death tolls are we counting? I mean, you know better than me that almost every day, 60, 65 people in Kabul have lost their lives. That 600 in 21st century is 10 days of life in Kabul, you know? Isn't there still a bit of perhaps, in my opinion, and perhaps yours, I don't know, discrepancy between what is one life for a mother who's lost a son or a father who's lost a son? Or when in the same page you say the U.S. must also take some credit. Their empire has been the most benign in history. George W. Bush, much criticized for what was seen as a belligerent foreign policy, would have been perceived as a very gentle Roman emperor. Based on that comparison, then we should compare some of the autocrats with Attila Hahn. Is that the right way of looking at the challenges?
I think you're dead right that we have to be very careful about reducing human lives to stats. My point is that you know, the stats are so overwhelmingly improved on previous centuries. Now, that clearly doesn't make it acceptable that people are still losing loved ones in Afghanistan, else, you know, all over the Middle East at the moment. It clearly doesn't mean that we shouldn't work even harder to get that number down, including the numbers who are dying of poverty, which is, you know, again, another stat which is going in the right direction, but must continue to go faster and faster. So I don't want to just reduce that human cost two stats. But I do also want to, you know, there's this sense, and I think social media increases this, that, oh God, you know, the world is just falling apart around us, and it's all terrible, bombarded with all these terrible images of collapse and decay globally. Actually, you know, the stats are on our side. They are going in the right direction. Our role is just to make them go faster in the right direction.
Okay. Now let me challenge you a bit more.
Sure.
When a lot of times governments say if a country cannot protect its own citizens, we have to interfere, right? Right to protect, and I think it was one of right to intervene or right to protect. Kofi Annan came up with that perhaps initiative. Every year in the United States, close to 48,000 people lose their life to oxycodones and, you know, opioids. 50,000 die from perhaps gun violence. So every 11 minutes, one American citizen dies from overdose. That is 130 human beings per day. And if you do that math from year 2000, it brings you to roughly a good 2 million people have lost. So in 5 years' time, if this trend continues, would one of the emerging superpowers have the right to intervene because America cannot protect its own citizens? Where are the lines drawn in terms of intervention?
Very interesting idea, actually. And it's another point where there is a certain amount, to use our word from earlier on, a certain amount of humbug around. You know, we're often quite happy to intervene in other countries. Certainly the big powers have been in recent years, but would be quite resentful if someone suddenly turned up and started doing the same thing to us. I think, you know, an intervention is to try and set stronger global rules. You know, if you look at something like say counterfeiting, mm-hmm. you know, something much more kind of practical like that, you know, you can see how the global structures we put up to defend us against counterfeiting. And yet, as you say, we can't do the same thing to defend Americans against the NRA,
mm-hmm.
Who are able to use the frailties in American system of government and politics and money to keep putting so many lives at risk. It's one of those that, you know, people often say how that the UK and America are two nations divided by a common language. Churchill mm-hmm. said it. It's one of those areas where I think that there's sort of disbelief in the UK that this can still be happening.
Do you think we're running out of vocabulary? You know, do you think diplomacy needs new terms? Because many of these terminologies have been used for hundreds of years, centuries, but their resonance in every country, in every intervention is different, right? In every crisis. Is it time to rewrite? I mean, I think, you know, encyclopedia, it's not just packaging it, but really coming up in a neurolinguistic programming kind of thing. Do you think we need new terminologies and to build that trust?
Well, for a start, I think the diplomats need to speak more human. So they need to use the language that everyone else is using much, much more. It always drove me mad that, you know, we are gravely concerned about the situation in Syria. And I used to write articles and blogs saying, I'm not gravely concerned, I'm furious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm devastated by what's happening in Syria. But at the same time, there are moments, and you know, seasoned diplomats will all have their battle stories of how actually finding a nuanced word or, you know, a form of compromise through the language
mm-hmm.
has helped them to resolve a situation. But no, I think overall the most important thing is that diplomats are able to communicate not just with each other and not just with leaders, but with the public at large now. And to do that, you have to speak human.
Tom, is it an opportunity to develop a brokerage company, a diplomatic brokerage? Because there's no honest brokers for some of these crises. You know, would there be merit in not, because, you know, some accuse UN as a talk shop, which I disagree. But many of the institutions where some of these dialogues have to take place, and you've been at the core of it, having served various prime ministers, is there an opportunity for creating genuine, grounded, real dialogue between what we want to call world leaders? And because I think leadership is in short supply at the moment. Is there an opportunity for creating a new environment in which the Chinese, the Americans, the Russians, the Brits, and the emerging powers, India, Brazil, in Middle East, some stakeholders, to have a proper human dialogue that you're talking about? Or is that a lost cause and I'm just dreaming?
No, there's definitely an opportunity. I mean, I wouldn't say it would be very profitable. business model. But look, you'll still need to have states and their representatives talking to each other through the formal channels. Mm. But actually, there are a number of initiatives along the lines you mentioned. There are some fantastic former diplomats. A lot of diplomats who really feel that craft that goes beyond just representing their nations and their states. And so you find a lot of that, a lot of the best diplomacy at the moment is happening in those ways. Often starts, we call track two diplomacy, often starts with these different organizations mm-hmm. outside the classic state-based diplomacy. You look at a lot of the people-to-people work that was going on between the different groups in Northern Ireland, that was going on, and you know, in the absence of a proper diplomatic framework between Israel and Palestine. You look at some of the work that the Vatican and others were leading on Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are organizations in New York now who are offering diplomatic support and representation to countries that otherwise wouldn't have it. And so there is activity there around the margins, but I'm not sure any of us involved in it would be making much money out of it.
No, I appreciate that. Maybe it could be a not-for-profit, but for a good cause.
Yes.
Sometimes when I think about the region and Middle East region at large, it looks to me like a very delicate fabric, which was given to very two poor and amateur tailors, Sykes Picot, who have been able only to make straight cuts without understanding the fabric, then building an outfit that has not been made to measure for the intricacies of these old historic bodies. And they're still tagging along in the same suit. Is there room for saying, acknowledging some of those? Is that not the first step to say, you know, we goofed up and let's look at it. Let's look at, you know, how we can, through culture, through arts, through economy, create tighter seams among you rather than, you know, this deformed, perhaps outfit.
Well, look, the borders that they actually drew, or, you know, the tailoring they did, a lot of that was never actually applied to the Middle East. It's become this sort of a shorthand for the goofing, this idea that the Brits and the French just carved it all up over a, you know, a glass of wine in a gentleman's club in London. Clearly, you know, I said once when I was in Lebanon that we need a new Sykes-Picot, and it was reported as me basically calling for another Sykes-Picot. What I actually said was, we need a new Sykes-Picot, but the tailors now effectively need to be from the region. Mm-hmm. It's the region to work out how to organize its affairs. I don't think that the way to do that is just to rip apart all the borders that currently.
No, I wasn't advocate. I said, as a matter of fact, I said by stitching it closer through arts, through culture, through economic prosperity, and that was my point. Now, if today you are invited to, I think diplomacy at large has turned into a fast food chain. Now, I want to pick your brains. If you had to go to Trump kitchen, what would be the meal you would order? If you go to Merkel kitchen, what would be the meal you order? In Boris kitchen, Emmanuel kitchen, Vladimir kitchen, or anybody else? Which kitchen would you like to be eating out from a diplomatic appetite at the moment in the world?
So I won't comment on Britain because I'm too... you know, I can't be objective on Britain. I'm biased.
Okay.
I would not be eating at Trump kitchen.
Okay.
I think he's done a huge amount to undermine the basic structures of international cooperation on which we so depend. Mm-hmm. I think that his policies on climate change and on the Middle East are incredibly troubling. So I would pass by that kitchen because I think I would probably get food poisoning if I ate there. Which brings me on to Vladimir Putin. Right. Perhaps we shouldn't joke about being poisoned in a Putin kitchen. I would really love to see Russia moving from playing that disruptive role to playing that more constructive role as a real global power. I do think that's possible, but we haven't seen huge evidence of it. I would want to go and eat in the UN kitchen if I could because I think that's ultimately where we are going to fix many of these problems. But at the moment, the UN is lacking resource and power. So if I'm not allowed to eat in the UN kitchen, I would eat in the kitchen of any country, any leader who is trying to build that rules based system, who's trying to get behind those global rules that we rely on so much.
Okay, so let's go to sounds very interesting, but let's go a little bit to the Far East kitchen. and you know the situation in Hong Kong. In 1967, in union unrest in Hong Kong, while still under British control, 51 people died in those riots in 7 months. It's been 5 months that Hong Kong has been grounded to steel, basically, you know, airport, market, etc. And when you look at it, you would have expected that China must have by now reacted in a very, you know, Bruce Lee fashion and, you know, the dragon enters. And when you compare that with Gilets Jaunes, with Catalonia, with, you know, some of the complexities, one has to pause and say, are we adding more fuel to the frustration and to the complexities by criticizing China? Or should there be an acknowledgement that, hey, you know, based on what we expected and based on historical track record of Hong Kong in 1967, so far, okay, not wow, not well, of course not, but so far China has been very restrained on Hong Kong. Would you agree with that?
So, I mean, Hong Kong is a classic example of what happens as power shifts between declining powers and rising powers. You know, I think it's terribly sad to see what is happening to people who are legitimately protesting for their own rights and freedoms, the freedoms that we always told them they would have under one country, two systems. But of course, you know, I think we do acknowledge China's, you know, right to have a view. It's China's right to be a power in its own region. I think we spend a lot of time talking about the importance of that. But that shouldn't mean that we can't also stand up to China when, you know, when it overstretches, when it does things that challenge those freedoms and rights that we believe are so important and that we believe can be part of the East and not just part of the West.
No, I totally agree. But I'm trying to say that if Occupy Wall Street would have brought New York and JFK for 5 months to the halt and to, you know, standstill, I don't think that we would have seen, very lovey-dovey approach from, you know, bringing the city back into the order. That's what I'm trying to say. So I sometimes, when I look at some of, you know, I mean, Catalonia the other day and Barcelona and Gilets Jaunes, as I said, and that brings me to our original conversation about understanding, about harmony, something that you're a big advocate of, you know, why Alliance Française is a good thing, but Confucius centers are a bad thing for the rise of China, mm-hmm. you know? So that's that. But I have to move on and to something that is very, very important. Family businesses are grounds of politics, diplomacy. What do you think family businesses can learn from diplomatic world? What do you think this, you know, the traits of Medici's and, you know, some family businesses are in seventh, sixth generation, longer than many governments, longer than some parties. What are the key learnings there, do you think, for family businesses from seasoned diplomats or crossroads of diplomatic continuity of these businesses for betterment of economy and their future generations and the world at large?
So I think, I mean, there's a lot that diplomacy can learn from the successful family businesses, particularly those that run for many, many generations, about how you can serve and use power, how you develop future leaders in the right way. How you manage that resource effectively. I mean, I think there's probably a fascinating discussion to be had about specifically that question. I was very struck by a conversation with one huge UK entrepreneur just a few weeks ago, who's really thinking about these things. And I was saying, you know, that there's such importance from all of us moving from a set of CV values, the things that we've done, the list of the awards we've got or the places we've studied, to a set of eulogy values. What do people say about us after we've gone? And he said something very interesting, which was that he also has to think, as someone who is passing on enormous amounts of wealth to future generations, not just about how he's regarded when he goes, but how his grandchildren will regard him, how his great-grandchildren will regard him, and how they will be regarded too. There's that sense of that legacy going on and on. You look at some, you know, a big name like Rhodes, you know, for decades, he's been associated with, you know, with scholarships and with philanthropy. And yet now his statue is being ripped down. So mm-hmm. are decisions that, for example, these big family businesses are taking now on climate, you know, will they be vilified for them in 50 years or 100 years? I think you really have to have that breadth of approach and vision.
Well, climate change is very much, in my opinion, intertwined with the issue of refugees and migrants. And you lived in a country with 4 million population and 2 million refugees and asylum seekers. When you look at Europe, in 2016 to 18, altogether, around 770,000 migrants came and were settled. That is less than 1% of the 770 million population of Europe. I still get gripped when I remember Aylin Kordi's clenched fist on Turkish shores. I'm sure you do as a father as well. Haven't we lost the art of communicating to the citizens, the global citizens in the Western Hemisphere in particular, that because of climate change, we may be the refugees tomorrow morning ourselves, in more ways than one, whether we like it or not, and then to share the real numbers of these crises with these people, that as a result of, you know, You call them adventures in your book. I call them interventions, occupations, a little bit more, perhaps candid. But isn't there a myopic view on the weight of population of immigrants coming from many of these geographies in North Africa and Middle East, parts of, you know, as a result of interventions and climate change? I mean, and agriculture is being challenged. Do you think the discussion with citizens is genuine, or immigration and refugees have been turned into, a scapegoat for failure in delivering what they had to in Western Hemisphere for their citizens?
So I'm a migrant worker myself. I've moved to the Middle East and I'm building a life and a business for my family out there. I think that politicians, particularly in the West, and particularly on the extremes of politics, have lied to the populations about the nature of migration, about the risks of migration. I think you're right that the climate crisis will put us in an age of people on the move such as we've never seen before. And that, for me, is why I spend so much time now working on the global education crisis, because either those people will be coming towards us angry and hungry and without hope, and without education, or they'll be coming towards us as future doctors and engineers and teachers. And so getting that right, I think, is not just an act of some sort of humanitarian charity, but is actually also an act of self-preservation.
You know, Tom, you're a technology driven, intellectual. In Northern California, about 2 weeks ago, Northern California Electricity Company shut down the electricity to thousands of houses in Bay Area, Silicon Valley, Mountain View, and, you know, the heart of global tech, because of the increasing temperatures. And they were afraid that it will cause fire, so they shut down the substations and they went into dark. And I was wondering how many of them know each other by their first name rather than the owner of the Chihuahua or the owner of this and that. How many of them could knock on the door and ask for a candle? How, you know, many of the values that are still in emerging countries are a lost art. And I think, to your point, we should go back to humanizing that we're all in this journey together, in my opinion. And at times, I still believe that the DNA of kindness and humanity is ever more important in the world we live in. Would you agree with that assessment?
I strongly agree with that. It's where I end the book, is with this call for us all to be citizen diplomats, to try and use these skills of empathy and emotional intelligence and curiosity and human connection to build a world capable of withstanding these challenges that we have ahead of us. And again, coming back to the education project, we ended up concluding that we need to refocus on not just knowledge, but skills and character, head, hand, and heart. And the three things that we focused on in terms of heart, in terms of the character that you need to thrive in the 21st century, were that we need a generation to be kind, curious, and brave.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
More than ever. So I can.
You talked about going to the end of your book, and I cannot tell you that I would love to continue this conversation, but that has to bring me slowly but surely towards the end of our conversation. But one suggestion I have is a cradle-to-grave cost analysis of Brexit. That would be an interesting one. And maybe as a diplomat, you can look at it. That this whole exercise, the opportunity cost, the whole thing, how much did it cost and how much of real savings in terms of, at least economically, we will have. But that's a different story. Your forefathers were makers and sellers of arrows as Fletchers.
Yes.
What is Tom Fletcher's next bullseye? Are you joining Google with your love of all things like Nick Clegg? Are you going back to go to Foreign Office and revisiting some of your predictions like Lebanon 2022? And who knows, some ambassadors get reposted. Would you be running for London's mayoral race in 2020? Because I think you would be a fabulous mayor. Or why not forming completely, completely new party, shaking politics, and running for number 10 and becoming a 50-year-old prime minister?
Well, they all sound great fun. And thank you very much for the confidence. I don't know whether the British public or would share your confidence, but I'm very touched by it. I'm on the landing card when I'm on a plane. I with a small D maybe, but I still see myself as a diplomat, and that still very much is my craft.
Mm-hmm.
But I've written, and as we've discussed, you know, you can be a diplomat without being formally in the business of statecraft and formal diplomacy. And I think many of the things I'm trying to do through our foundation, the Foundation for Opportunity at the moment, are diplomacy in different forms. I'm having great fun doing that, supporting refugee education, supporting women in diplomacy, all sorts of initiatives which you know, get me out of bed in the morning, get me excited. So I don't know. I mean, I spent a lot of time on education. I love spending time with teaching and with students, developing that next generation and learning from them. And I'm trying to write a novel at the moment. Maybe okay. that's the next one. You know, actually tackling many of the themes that you and I have discussed just now, but through mm-hmm. through fiction.
Well, so, listen, you've mentioned in the past you're a failed boxer. No one can disagree that you have punched way above your weight and got into some of the most demanding diplomatic rings. Perhaps a few diplomats, as albeit the fact you said you're also a failed singer and lead singer, have sang as fresh and a novel tune as you have. And I have no doubt that you're just training for the heaviest weight and working on your vocals. And we will soon have you back in the ring and to hear from you. And if none of that works, I mean, that photo with Aston Martin in Beirut, perhaps the next Bond, who knows? But
I love that. I think I promise you I won't take up singing again or take up boxing again. Anything else is on the table.
Well, listen, thank you for joining me, Tom Fletcher, on Round Peg Podcast. I'm sure we will have you back on the program, and this conversation is to be continued as the world around us evolves. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Ali. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I'd like to thank my guest, Tom Fletcher. Thank you for listening. I hope you can tune in and join us on our next podcast, where I will be joined all the way from Ottawa by Senator Ratna Omidwar. We will be talking current issues, real issues of the world we live in, including migration, including refugee crisis, including development, and how we can develop economic prosperity at home and beyond.